Should we begin with a prayer?
Yes, so we're here for stories and life lessons from Swami. This is our second class, and yes, let's begin with her. Do you want to lead the prayer? Do you want me to?
Okay.
All right, let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Great Masters.
Great Masters.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna.
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda.
Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda.
Saints of all religions.
Saints of all religions.
Friend and guide Swami Kriyananda.
Friend and guide Swami Kriyananda.
Lovingly we bow before you all.
Lovingly we bow before you.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Be with us this evening.
Be with us this evening.
Fill us with inspiration.
Fill us with inspiration.
Help us to feel thy love.
Help us to feel thy love.
See thy light.
See thy light.
As we commune with each other in this satsang.
As we commune with each other in this satsang.
And hear these stories.
Hear these stories.
And learn from each other.
And learn from each other.
Om.
Om.
Peace.
Peace.
Amen.
Amen.
Let's take just a very brief moment to center ourselves. Om. Welcome, everyone, to this second week. We're going to start with Shanti, and then we'll have some questions, if there are any questions, assuming there will be afterwards, and then we'll go on from there. So it's all yours.
Okay. So, what an unusual place I find myself in tonight. I never thought I would be the one telling stories about Swamiji. I had a very unusual relationship with Swami in terms of people who would typically be up here. But I'll tell you, interestingly, in the last month, not having anything to do with this class, that I've begun to realize some of the ways that he has been with me over all these years that I never knew. And honestly, I forgot that I wasn't thinking that much about this class because I'm just here one night and it's just not anything I would see myself doing. So independent of that, I have started to really, I would say understand, but it's not understand. It's to begin to know the ways that Swamiji came into my life, the way he walks into so many people's lives. You know, these stories are obviously either things we've observed or personal stories with him, but we all know they're not really personal. Every single story that we could tell, every observation we have, there's a spiritual lesson there. And the spiritual lessons are universal. So I just say that before we start. I think many of you know I came up here in 1979 through several acts of guidance, medical school being one of them, but the other piece of it, and it's a story that I've told before, is that right before I moved up here, I was in a bookstore in San Diego, and a man walked up to my husband and I as we were talking and got really right in my face. He was a really big, furry-looking man, big beard. This was down in a bookstore, a very well-known metaphysical bookstore in San Diego. Loud voice, he says to me, "Did I hear you say you're moving up to Palo Alto?" I said, "Yes, you did." "The first thing you do," he said, just like this, with his finger in my face, "the first thing you do is you go to East West Bookstore." I said, "Okay." That's what he said to me. So anyway, we went there soon after coming up here, and instantly walking into that bookstore, I mean, as the universe will just do what it does, and Master does what he does, I met a couple of people who I just instantly bonded with. And then over time developed a very deep, deep relationship with Vasudeva, who was then Jacqueline. They were running that store from the beginning. Swamiji sent Jacqueline down here first to do it, and then Vasudeva. But So the connection started through that store. But I met Swamiji later that year, so it was late 1979. So I've really known him for a very long time. And I know, as all of you know, because you've heard this, I could not relate to Swamiji at first. And I say at first, it was many years. I didn't know this then. I wouldn't have said these words. I was simply not ready for that level of teaching or that type of teaching. But I was instantaneously and never without a doubt completely drawn into Ananda. I loved everything Ananda. I loved the people. I loved the music. Immediately very involved in the community, which in hindsight, of course, is absurd because the community was just the pure manifestation of Master's energy flowing through Swamiji, and it was all Swamiji. I mean, the whole vibration, everything that I was loving was him. But we were up at the village a lot and around him a lot because in those days, we had no money, but we were considered wealthy by Ananda standards. I could truly say we had very little money. But whatever fundraising was going on, we would always be of those people giving the most, my husband and I. And I mean, it could have been a couple of hundred or a few hundred dollars, but it was a lot in those days. And in those days, they used to have these fundraising, and then the top 10 people, 15 people, whatever it was, we'd get to go up and have dinner with Swamiji. And I remember one of those dinners, I was sitting around the big table in the dome. There must have been 15 or 20 of us. And in the middle of the meal, he stopped apropos of nothing, and he stares at Barry Rosen, who I think most of you don't know, but my first husband. And he just stares at the two of us, and he says, now, I went by Sally in those days. Sally and Barry, they're good people, he said, just like that. He said, but they've got so much ego about them. Loud, booming voice. He said, but they're going to get rid of that in this life, and then they'll really be able to do good work. Then he picks up his spoon and he starts eating. You know, what was really remarkable about that, which I realized immediately, that I did not take offense to that, which is pretty, because he was right, of course, about the ego. But given that particularly, I mean, given any human being really, but was obviously apparent about us, it didn't offend me. Somehow I knew there was truth in it. I knew it was coming through Swamiji. It just made perfect sense to me. We all started eating. We went back to whatever conversation we were having. And as you can see, I mean, almost 40 years later, it's still very much with me. I mean, I've thought of that story many times. He had somehow that way of being able to speak the truth when it was so appropriate, so right for whoever it was, that was not a hurtful statement to me. Somehow he knew that. So it's a very compelling story in my mind, and that I received it spoke to me about, I don't know, the disarming nature of loving honesty is what I would say. And his honesty, disarming nature, because it didn't bother me. I didn't feel criticized. I felt seen. And that was an amazing thing. So time went by for me. I found myself, I remember my sister died. I don't remember what year that was. Anyway, it doesn't matter, but it would matter, but if I have to figure it out right now, she had been born in 45 and she was 42, so 87. And I don't know when Swamiji wrote the oratorio. Do you remember, Rambhakta, what year the oratorio was written? It must have been about 85, early 80s, because I came home. I'd spent the last couple of weeks of her life with her, then cleaned out of her apartment, and I just wanted to be alone for a week. And for reasons I still don't understand, I put on the oratorio, and I listened to it over and over and over. It really got me through my grief. Whatever that music was, whatever way, I mean, we could go through song by song and talk about the deep connection to God through Jesus and the uplifting nature of so much of that music. We all know it. It's so fresh in our minds right now, particularly. But and I remember thinking, that man is touching my life, and probably, I said to myself, millions of lives in ways we can't know, because I still could not be with Swamiji. But in all of the ways that I, when I was in need, I was very connected with Ananda. I mean, throughout all of this, very connected. So, with again, with the people, there was a house in Atherton. I was there constantly, the whole time it was there. Barry and I made all of the food every Sunday after service. Then we would have a big meal at the Atherton house. So, I mean, just to say I was completely a part of Ananda. If I fast forward, just to tell you, whenever Asha had the manuscript for her book, Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, she gave me a copy of that manuscript. And I remember I said to her, please don't give it to me. And she said, why? And I said, I have no time to read it, and I don't want you to be insulted. It wasn't published yet. So she said, I don't care if you read it or not. I want you to have it. That's what she said to me. So when I got into bed that night, I said to myself, I'll read a story. Anyway, I finished the book about 6 or 7 in the morning. I'd read the whole book. And what I realized when I read that book is that almost all of those stories had taken place in the years. I think most of you have probably read the book. I mean, if you have not, it's beautiful. Story by story by story. But all of those stories had taken place in all of the years that I was feeling I couldn't be near Swamiji. I would say to myself, he's very intellectual and I'm a bhakti. And there were shades of that. He was. Intellectual master had told him, you need to develop more devotion. So, I mean, as is always true, when you want to find fault, you find the thread of truth and you hang on to it. But that book, it really changed my life. It opened me up to Swami Kriyananda. I mean, it's a long time ago now. I had been opening anyway, but when I read that book, I saw him in a way that I had never been able to see him. From the time I read that book, and I had a change of heart and soul, is all I can say, Swamiji started reaching out to me, which he had never really done before. He was never mean to me or anything, but we just had nothing to do with each other. But he started reaching out, and this is the main lesson that I started thinking about a month ago, because there are so many stories. He started inviting me to things in this way. After an event that we did here, a big event, he was going to take all of us who had helped organize out for dinner. And as we get out of the car at the restaurant, and there's at least 15 people, maybe more, he looked at me and he said to me, Shanti, I want you to sit right across from me. I want to look at you. That's all he said to me. In the restaurant, we went to that Indian restaurant at the corner of, what is that? It's Selva, not Selva. You know, at El Camino, right near the car wash. You know that Indian restaurant. We were walking in. It's not Amber, no, but it's just in the, they have that Indian buffet all the time. I haven't been there for a while now. Anyway, we went there. Sit right across from me. I want to look at you. When we went, there was a big book launch down in Los Angeles. Actually, for both of the book launches. One, we had a big dinner at Barvi's home. I don't know if anybody else was there, but she had everybody for dinner. I mean, 100 people at least in her backyard. And when I walked in, they had seated people. You know, you got a place card. And somebody said, oh, Shanti, you're at Swamiji's table. And I said, oh, no. I said, there must be another Shanti coming. And I mean, I said that. But it turns out that Dharmaraj was there. That's when Dharminian Dharmaraj was. And he said to me, no, Swamiji asked that you be at his table. So who was at his table? John Parsons, me, and Dharmaraj. That's who sat with Swamiji. And the other, we had another book launch. We had a big, it was in a hotel. I don't remember what hotel it was, but it was in L.A., and there were these huge round tables set up. And everybody's walking around looking for their names, same thing. And Swamiji has me, and when we all go to sit down, whoever was next to him, he said, could you move over? I want Shanti to sit here. Now, mind you, we hardly said 10 words to each other in any of these meals. He did say a few sentences, which I could share. I mean, they weren't personal. But for all these years, I kept thinking, what was he doing? What was he trying to tell me? Because I listen to these stories like you do. Everybody says, oh, and Swamiji said this, and here was the lesson. I never got the lesson. About a month ago, I said to myself, he was not teaching you a lesson. He was doing what Swamiji does. He saw what was going to go on for you. He saw your life. He was simply giving you energy. He was feeding you in a way that would sustain you through these years of, you know, great service and commitment here and a lot of work to be done. And I think he was just, I mean, I feel as soon as that came into my head that that was the truth. That without words, without any degree of a personal connection, other than that, in all these years since 1979, I've never felt anything but love and acceptance from him, ever. Even, I mean, in so many more instances and things that happened. I remember one time we did a big event out on the green here. I don't remember what the event was, but Swamiji was meant to talk that day, of course. This was in Palo Alto. And he was very, very sick. That's when David and Asha were still in 108, and he was upstairs. And he had a very high fever. And Peter was at some conference, I mean, in another, maybe on the East Coast or something. And everybody here was really worried about Swamiji. And so finally, Asha came and said, could you come and see him? But everybody was there. I mean, Jyotish, Devi, there were several of the women who were affectionately called the Matas from the village who would sort of protect Swamiji. And I went upstairs, and he was really hot. And he was due to give this talk in about an hour and a half. And we were all thinking, no way. But I said to him, Swamiji, we have to get your fever down. You know, he was older and sick, and I was worried. And I said, so we're going to take just cool rags, and we're going to put them all around your head and on the back of your neck. And I said, how does that sound? And he said, absolutely, what did he say? Utterly horrible. That's what he said. How does that sound? Utterly horrible. He was so hot in the idea of having something cold. And I said, you know, it's going to bring your fever down and you'll feel better. So Jyotish was there, the voice of reason. He just looked at all the women and gave them a nod. And four of the women went out and got these cool rags and put them on Swamiji. So then he said to me, as his fever starts coming down, do you think I should talk? And I said, well, I don't know, Swamiji, do you feel like it? I said, you know, you don't look like a rose right now. That's what I told him. He said, well, let's wait and see. In about 40 minutes, he said to me, you think I should talk, don't you? And I said, yes. I mean, I didn't, but I could see that's where he wanted me to say it because I was the doctor. It was like giving to get these other people. And he went out, and you would never have known outside anything was wrong with him. He gave an extraordinary talk for an hour. He stood on this. No, he had that chair. In fact, he had the chair, I think it was the chair from my house, you know, sitting. Remember how we made a platform for him out in the middle of the green? And anyway, we did. That's exactly right. You know, I'm trying to think of the woman. Oh, she was with Jeffrey for a while. What was her name? No, before Sylvia. It wasn't his wife. She actually then left with the other woman that she lived with. I can't think of her name. She was there for a long time. Nobody's remembering. Anyway, she did the flowers that day, and it was like a life-changing experience for her. She was a beautiful singer. She got a lot of solos for a long time. I'll remember her name later and tell all of you. You'll remember it then. She lived in the community for a few years. But anyway, she did the flowers. I remember it was gorgeous. He looked so beautiful out there, just absolutely radiant. Then he went back in and promptly became very sick again. And I'm telling you all this. I'll tell one more short story, then I'm going to stop. You know, he was very sick for a lot of years. I think you all remember that. And for a while, he had that cough. He could not quit coughing. I think it lasted for a year and a half at least. Many times I thought to myself, he's not going to be around in the morning. I mean, it was. I remember thinking at the Village one night. But, you know, he lived many years after that. But never once did he get up and apologize for his condition. Every once in a while, he'd say, don't get old. You know, that, I mean, if he walked out on a dais, I remember him saying that in L.A. But he would never say, I'm sorry about this cough, or apologize for himself. He didn't walk out that day on the green and say, you know, I was just sick, but not a word about it. Just brought his energy up. You would never have known there was anything wrong with him. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone to apologize for something before I would talk. Gee, I'm sorry, my voice is hoarse. I said to myself, don't do it. Because there was so much wisdom in the fact that that just lowers the energy. It's a very contractive, restrictive, it's a totally different energy than standing up and being well. I mean, even if your body isn't. It was such a beautiful lesson to learn from him and to see him do it over and over. So, I think maybe I'll stop there. Does anybody have any? Sarah?
Well, I've been with, can you hear my voice all right? I've been with Ananda since 1982, and I started out at the Atherton House. But I don't remember you.
I was there, I promise you.
Because there weren't that many people. If we had 15 people at a Sunday service, it was a big deal. You know, in the living room, you remember that.
My husband and I made all the food for you every Sunday, I promise you. Ram and Diana got married. Jacqueline and Vasudeva moved down.
Yeah, no. And then I went up to San Francisco about 6 months later. But yeah. It was in 1982 or 83 anyway. Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's very interesting. But anyway, we were there. Ramurti just recently brought me a picture of himself and his son and me in that house. Interestingly, just... Yes, we looked very different. We did look very different.
Well, I remember when you moved into the community, because I was living upstairs, and you were still known as Sally, and you lived downstairs from one over from me. I remember that. Isn't that strange?
Yeah, we all go back. Well, anyway, I'm going to give the mic over, but I just want this mic. But I just want to say of whatever I spoke about, the most important lesson for me and for all of us, because life is not what it looks like, and I was just... We know this, we all know this, but it just came back to me so deeply and with utter clarity on this pilgrimage. We are living in a sea of energy that has been infused with these masters, with their energy. And, you know, when Master says, my vibration is in the ether, and when I realized that that's what Swamiji was doing, just giving me energy... Just like I realized last weekend, for all of us to feel the energy that Master was giving us on this pilgrimage, it's the same thing. You know, all we need to do is be open to receive it. I could feel a change in my life a month ago when I had that realization about Swamiji. I mean that literally. I thought Swamiji was readying me for this, and I just feel like I... catapulted through a few incarnations with that knowing his energy was there. And I think that's really true for all of us, because it's what they're out there to do. But it was just, he did it even when I didn't know he was doing it, just in a calm, quiet, other than a little instruction, sit here, go there, let me look at you. Who would have thought?
Thank you, Shanti. That was great. While we're switching mics over for Lahari, it makes me wonder, in those times, those years, Shanti, when you weren't feeling to be close, if maybe that was all part of the grand plan of, therefore, don't get mentally connected to Swami in order to eventually just be in that place to receive all that energy. Okay, here we are with Lahari. You got it?
Well, that was a perfect way to start. This is the fourth year, I believe, the third year of 4 years that we've been having these stories that I've been coming. And I thought, why do we continue doing this year after year? You know, I don't really want to come and tell the same stories year after year for many reasons. And I thought, there's a really good reason why we're doing this, and I want to address that right now. As Shanti was saying, she didn't have that many personal contacts with Swamiji, and the ones that were there were enough. They gave the energy and the connection that was needed. And I think going forward is what I was thinking about for tonight. Asha wrote the book, Swami as We've Known Him, and started the tradition of telling stories, many people gathering together and saying this, you know, Swamiji said this, he did that, this happened, and I grew, and I learned this lesson, or I learned that lesson. And it helped us all, and many people who didn't know Swami, get to know him through those stories. Because really, they're just about, you stand back, you look at the big picture, they're about sincere disciples coming to Yogananda, wanting to walk the path of self-realization, learning from Swami Kriyananda many of the lessons that they needed, and taking them forward, being active and developing themselves around those lessons. And that's just the tradition. And with this tradition of storytelling, what I'm thinking now is that people who've come to these classes and people in the community and anywhere, these stories will continue, because it doesn't matter that some of us lived with Swamiji. You know, I often tell people, you know, the hours that I spent with him, I had more hours than many people have told me, and it's true. But it's, you know, maybe it's just really my good karma, which obviously I think it is, incredibly good karma to have had that time with Swamiji in his presence, to meditate around him, to, you know, once in a while draw one line. I used to get one line a year. I mean, I'd given my life to this, and basically through Swamiji, he was the one who taught me Hong Sa. I had deep experience from that first class. I didn't know this man. I'd read in someone's bookshelf, I'd read the autobiography. I hadn't read The Path. I'd read Spiritual Sun Signs. I wasn't even that interested in astrology, but it's what my friend had on her bookshelf. So that's what I'd read. Then I went up to Ananda Village. Swamiji came on, taught Hong Sa. Boom. I was taken to a state of consciousness that I'd never experienced, that I dreamed about, that I'd hoped, you know, that I knew saints had. I just had never had anything like that. So right away, it was an awakening. And so I say good karma, but I also say bad karma. You know, why did the poor guy have to spend that much time, you know, with this little devotee? Because, you know, I wasn't going to get it any other way, perhaps. You know, good karma from past lives, whatever it was. But isn't so important, I'm seeing, as time goes on, as Swamiji left the body. And it's often that the people who are around a saint while they're alive, there's an image that comes with, I think it was Ramakrishna's devotees. Many of them lived with him every single day. And he was this incredible light. So the image is that he was like a beautiful light with a candle, a flame, and it cast a little bit of a shadow right underneath, as flames do. So there was like a circle that was a little bit shaded from the pure light of the candle. And when people get too close to a master, sometimes they make it so personal. It's, you know, it's about me and we did this together and he did that with me. And, you know, it becomes just this little tiny bit of what's available in the light. So I'm hoping just that this tradition stays alive, and it's a good enough reason to do it, not to tell the same stories over and over, but because the storytelling tradition is one of the ways that spiritual truths get transmitted. You know, when you have a context for something, you can say, God is the eight manifestations, love, light, sound, joy, wisdom, calmness, peace. I'm probably missing one, but you get the idea. You can say that and walk out of the room, and everybody's supposed to figure out how to get there. You can also have a lot of other ways to experience it. We have techniques. And then you can have stories where a person says, wow, you know, Yogananda, he went into the Himalayas, and he witnessed all these saints doing all these amazing things. And yogis can do those things. So it just expands our ability to experience that state of consciousness that the masters have. So I think that storytelling tradition is really important. Shanti spoke of this maybe at a Sunday service, but the book that Narayani just wrote, My Heart Remembers, about Swami, with stories about how she experienced his influence in her life, how she recognized him from a feeling in her heart. Some people recognized Swami and Master in the teachings by, you know, the mind saying, what is true, what is real, what is reality, you know, who am I? And they use their mind. So it's individual, and I think each person's story has a power to keep the tradition and the vibration and the transmission alive. And everybody here and everybody listening to this has stories. You know, I was telling someone just before class, Swami left the body. Finding Happiness movie came out. We had one of our devotees, who was with us now as one of our church members, come in, see the Happiness movie, look at this man called Swami Kriyananda, feel this amazing heart connection, very heart-filled devotion. Feel it, walked out thinking, oh my goodness, I can hardly wait to meet this man. Well, then she learned from somebody at Ananda, he'd left his body. Well, she felt very, very sad and a great loss. She really was looking forward to, you know, having a relationship with him. So a little time goes on, and this person, who promises me one day she's going to write this story up. It hasn't happened yet, so I keep telling it. This person at a healing prayer class we were giving shared this story. And the story is, disappointed, didn't get to meet Swami Kriyananda, is now at Stanford Hospital in the hallway waiting for the operating room to be ready so she can go have the fifth surgery for complications in the abdomen and scar tissues and different things. Great pains would come. She'd go to the doctor. He'd say, into the hospital, into the operating room, operate, go home. Another round, four rounds of the same going in the hospital surgery, same thing. This time was the fifth round. And she's a person who came to Ananda already with an active spiritual life of prayer and loving God and Jesus and Mary and having that lifelong practice and connection. And she had just seen the movie and felt this amazing power of Swamiji. So she started praying to him in the hallway. The room wasn't ready, so she's waiting. And she just started praying and just praying and praying and praying. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. It was about an hour. Why it took so long to get a hospital room, you know, one can ask. She was scheduled for the surgery. But as she was doing her praying to Swami Kriyananda, she saw him. She opened her eyes and she saw him. And she was very happy to see him, obviously. And she said she felt something come to her from him, like a blessing or a energy of some kind. And she said, in that moment, I could feel Something went through my body, and it felt like I was healed. Now, there she is, you know, being prepped. She's prepped. She's ready to go in. And somehow, I haven't heard this, and this is a person I'll give one small clue. She doesn't speak very much English, so her daughter translated this story for all of us, and I don't have all the details yet. Why did the doctor allow her to go back and get another X-ray? Well, he believed her that much, so she went through and had another X-ray for the thing they were going to operate on, and he came out and he said, it's changed. We don't need to operate. So the stories we can tell of, you know, I lived in India with Swamiji, I worked at Crystal Clarity, I saw him, I don't know. It was all like a moment, and I don't know, hundreds of times that I went and worked on him and sat in his presence and, you know, tuned in, didn't even try to tune in, just was taken on this wave of uplifting grace. You know, all those times, they're my story. But each person who comes into Ananda has a story with Swami Kriyananda. Master said he would be liberated. Death would be his final sacrifice. We celebrate his moksha. So he's so available to us. I mean, you read the path. He struggled a lot of the same ways that all of us struggled. He wasn't Yogananda who low went to the mountains and low, we know he was born an avatar. Swami Kriyananda was born almost liberated, but he had to go through things. And we watched him and he wrote about everything. And so he's very much there for us. So for my little part, I have a little bit more time. But I would say, start writing down your own stories. You know, what does Swami mean to me? Did I get any inspiration from that book? Because he is, it's like they say of Krishna, he would come to devotees like a thief in the night. And just a little bit of some wisdom from a soul like Swamiji really can lift us across the ocean of delusion. I found several of those lines and I've told stories about them. I'll just mention a few now in case any of them strike a note for you. One of the things I learned from Swamiji was the importance of humility. I first came to Ananda and I'd been given again early on blessings for whatever reason. Divine Mother needed to, you know, put the light on me really bright so that I would open my eyes and get that this was important. I'd been wandering for a while, and I really needed to be brought back. So I really felt so happy and full of joy and so much like I wanted to share that joy and so much like I wanted to give my guru everything big and beautiful and wonderful things like Swamiji had done from his done for his guru. And my first job at Ananda, I was just too full of this desire to be big in my service. And I had a little sign on my computer. I was just asked to be somebody's secretary at some of the work that I'd done, and this person was doing his thing, and I was trying to help make it all happen, and I was being the secretary. And I had on my computer, God is the doer, because I'd read that, and that sounded really great to me. Yes, God is flowing through me, and I'm not here, and God is the doer. Yes, that's what I want. So I'm sitting there, and Swami comes into the office. I'd been there a couple of months or something. He comes in, and he looks around. Oh, he says, God is the doer. Fantastic. And the way he said it, I had to think, now what did that mean? It is fantastic. Oh, it's one of my fantasies because I want to be like that. But you know what? I'm not like that yet. Okay, great. So that was for me to realize there's fantasy, there's affirmation, and then there's where are you? Also in the same office job, I think this story is told in Asha's book, but it was just a wonderful lesson in humility, very lovingly delivered and very deeply taken. I was in many jobs before. I helped executives, and often I had a love of language, and I was good in grammar. I would help them with their letters, so I would make them sound better. It was just part of my service. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't really. So I just did that with one of my new boss's letters, just thinking, I'm serving, you know, I'm helping, and it's going to be so much nicer this way. He's going to be happy. Well, he absolutely was not happy. Little did I know he had his own, you know, karmic battles he was doing around everything, and he was absolutely not happy. So he railed up to Swamiji, and he was just so upset, and, you know, and Swamiji said, you know, called me up to him and said, well, you know, I would not have liked it if someone changed a letter of mine. And then, you know, I was mortified. You know, oh, my goodness, I did the wrong thing, and this is horrible. And so, you know, the early lessons that we get. When I came to Ananda, as a child, started with, well, my mother and father had this beautiful relationship in many ways. And my father died, and I became very interested in the book Cinderella. Somehow it was feeding that place that had gone away, because there were my parents, and then suddenly my mother was there all sad. So I would read Cinderella. And I sort of got that was maybe going to happen, you know, that this wonderful prince was out there and there was this perfect love that was going to happen. And, you know, it would sort of take me off to the clouds. And, you know, I sort of was, that was my escape mechanism. And I had that as an incarnational thing, that I really wanted perfect love. And I thought it was going to come in some form or other. Gee, maybe it happens that way. Well, gee, maybe it doesn't happen that way for most people. And so that's kind of what I observed and saw as time went on. There are very few of those perfect prince and princess Cinderella in the castle kind of loves. So I kept looking, and, you know, read lots of books about different kinds of love, and, you know, platonic love, and mother love, and child love, and friend love, and the art of loving, and on and on and on. It was one of my themes. So I came to Ananda and started reading Master's book called The Divine Romance, and that gave me a nice little bridge. You know, it transferred the earthly castle and the lovely prince to a divine union of the male and female qualities in the soul, the mystical union. And so I started seeing, oh, there's a bigger picture here to this love that my heart's been longing for who knows how long. And then one time I was around Swamiji, and I hadn't told him all this about my Cinderella complex or anything like that, but he just looked at me one day. I don't even think anything was going on around it. He just said, perfect love is only found in stillness. And it was just like one of those little rafts across the ocean of delusion. Perfect love is only found in stillness. You know? And it just, in some way, freed me so much from that search. I mean, I still had to go through the unwinding of that karma, but perfect love is only found in stillness. And, you know, as I say, every year I would get one of these. And because he'd only give me one, maybe he knew I was so much a simpleton I couldn't have taken two, would have gotten too confused. But he'd give me one, and I would just think about it. What does that mean? How can I learn? What does he mean by that? What does the person at that level of freedom mean by that? And how can I lift myself to be more like that? Another thing I learned from him is truth is always kind. And he lived that. You know, Shanti gave the example of him giving that what could have sounded like a very sharp and maybe mean correction at a dinner about a person having ego. But Swamiji had a way. He led with his heart. He led with love. You could feel that love of your soul being, that's what he was holding you in, is who you were in your soul. And then if he said something like, you have a lot of ego, it wasn't like, you know, it was like, you have a lot of ego, but you know, you're going to be free of that. And always underneath and around it was seeing us as perfect souls. So he could get away with saying a lot of things to us because of that. You know, he could really be truthful, but kind at the same time. He gave me a couple of really big ones. One he gave me in India that just seared my heart. It sort of cauterized something in my heart. It was quite painful when I heard it. And the next day, he saw me. He'd given two of us the same correction, another lady and I, on a project we were working on. And he saw both of us, and he knew we were kind of the tender types, and he wondered how we were doing. He said, "You know, I love you both." I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's right. He loves us. So it doesn't really matter if we're not perfect yet. He sees us that way." One time when I was in a real karmic testing time, and I was suffering, feeling badly about something that was happening that I'd done, the karmic bombs, etc. And I called him on the phone. I only did that probably five times in my whole discipleship with Swamiji. I waited. I did my best. I asked others. And then when I couldn't get over it, I'd call him. And by the time that happened, I was really open. And I was really in dire fears and colossal sufferings. And I really was turning to him. So I would listen, especially keenly. So I called him and, "Swamiji, this is going on and that." And he said, "Suffering is caused by wishing things are other than what they are." So that was that year. being a person who loves harmony, one of the lessons that Swamiji, you know, had to give me was not to be discouraged, to have courage, to be strong, to be willing to fight. And, you know, that was always sort of vaguely hovering as I would be around him and watch him doing these amazing things, go through the SRF lawsuit, continue to fight for Dharma, no matter what came his way, no matter how icky it got, no matter anything, he just kept going the path of Dharma, never wavering to the left, never wavering to the right, completely focused, standing up. And there was a point where, I mean, many times I think in my heart I'd be like, "Isn't it enough, Divine Mother? Can't you just let this be over for him and for all of us? Isn't it enough?" But it wasn't enough until it was enough, until it was finished. He just kept going. And then Diamata left the body, and he'd planned to be in L.A. launching the book. I believe the book then was the biography of Yogananda. And in the book, Swami's pretty honest about what happened to him at SRF. He wasn't honest for years. He wasn't dishonest. He just didn't say what had happened, how he'd been treated. And he was really needing to get that out there. And so he did in that book. And some of us were like, "Whoa, that is really strong. You know, what will they think? What will Diamata think? What will SRF think? Whoa, he's really being strong here." And then Diamata left the body just as the book was supposed to launch. And I'm thinking, well, gosh, I mean, she did just die. So maybe we ought to wait a while before saying these things. I mean, it kind of seems like it would be a nice thing to do. And I remember, I hadn't seen him in a long time. We were in India and we visited briefly down in L.A. And he said, "Well, what do you think? I'm just about to launch that book tomorrow," and Diamata left the body, and I thought, he's asking me what I think. I said, "Well, Swamiji, I was thinking, you know, maybe we could wait a little while." He started laughing. This is how he corrected me. He started laughing. He said, "Oh, and if Lahari thinks we should wait, I know we're doing the right thing by not waiting." Like, I was like I heard from the wimp contingency, and I know what they think, and I know I'm doing the right thing now. You know, so it's like, you just can't wince. You know, when Dharma calls, you got to be willing to do it, even if it's not nice, even if it's not at all harmonious. He was a man of Dharma, and he was a man of ultimate kindness and love and compassion. And I mean, he only waited, how many years was that, since he got treated that way, and he felt Master had a mission to do. And it wasn't about him. He wasn't there. We were talking about the lawsuit the other day. When he was up there on the stand and everything, he wasn't really there. It was all happening around him, and he was just standing in Dharma. So it just kind of what it takes to be a spiritual warrior. Oh, another part of the humility factor that he gave me about that letter that he corrected me on. Because he didn't ever want to leave you feeling like, oh, I've done a bad thing or I'm not a good devotee, because he never saw anybody that way. And it's good for us to remember to really do our best not to see each other that way. Even if we're really off, you know, we've taken a detour and we're not being good devotees, it happens. But just to still see ourselves as devotees working toward liberation and free souls underneath the layers, you know, to really try and remind ourselves we're that, and all of our good advice are that too. What he said to me at that time, which was the thing I could hold on to for a year, because I wasn't going to hold on to the, I wouldn't have wanted you to write that letter. That would have been a horrible year. But what I could hang on to was what he told me after that, which is seek to be the least, and God will give you your rightful place. And I was trying too hard to give something grand to Master. Again, I still had to unwind that karma, but just knowing, just having this little raft, seek to be the least and God will give you your rightful place. You don't have to try so hard. As Gyanamata said, what is yours will come to you. How could it not? That's karma, the law of karma. It's magnetism. It's all the things we study. It will happen. And so we cannot have to try so hard. We have to be strong, you know, even-minded and calm through all, you know, we get all the lessons, we get all the instruction. But we can really trust that God is going to bring it to us. And so that, actually, that was more than a year. I still find that one is really, really a blessing to just remember. And then I'll close with this one, which is something he told another devotee. And I guess what I want to just reaffirm now is he's speaking to us always. You know, he can come to us in meditation and he will. He can come to us in prayer and he will. In whatever way our heart needs. In the book that we open, in the everything, but also personally. You know, after he died, there are many stories of how he appeared to people in Assisi, close disciples. He came to them. And I haven't done a toll, taken a toll yet of how many people have seen him since then. I've heard of the one. I've had dreams of him when he's guided, and he's there for all of us. You know, if we say, Swami, you are a guide, he takes that very responsibly, and that's his job. Master gave him that job, to guide us, and he's still doing that. And when we listen, we can hear it. He gave a wonderful lesson, the one I'll close with now, to a person who was working at Crystal Clarity, which Vidura, who was the community manager and did the staffing for everything in those days, people would come to him and say, I need a job, and he'd try and make it work from the personnel department in all the ways. He used to call Crystal Clarity Swami's Karma Mill, that anybody who went there, you know, the energy was so high that their karma would speed up so much and things would happen and it would be really, you know, a deal to work with all of that. And one of our people there, one of our senior at the time people there, was struggling. I didn't always know all the things. I knew later many things were happening in that person's life and family life. And the karma was really heating up and it was really difficult. And he was just barely holding his own. And he was a man who had kind of an outward persona, so all of us didn't really know. He didn't really share with us what was happening. But he had a meeting with Swamiji, and he came back from that meeting, and he quietly went to his desk, and he had written in big letters and put above a picture he had of Swamiji, freedom is the goal. And that was the one-liner that Swami had given him when he went to Swami to say, you know, I'm having this karmic time and I don't know what to do. And I can appreciate, I mean, some of the things that were happening eventually took this person off the path. But Swamiji, well, off the path. We're all on the path, as Master says. It's just the path of Kriya with Ananda. I didn't keep track of this person. I don't know where they are. But freedom is the goal. And we kind of just, I've remembered that because in retrospect, that person was at one of those critical times. You know, where do I go? Where do I turn? What do I do? You know, what's real? What's my karma? What should I, you know, what's happening here? And the words freedom is the goal, you know, can be so useful. Another one of those little rafts across the ocean of delusion. And just as a reminder, if you have a story, capture it, because if this goes on, it's going to be because people have new stories, things that they want to share. And it's alive. It's a living tradition. Swami's still alive, working with us. He used to say toward the end of his life, I'm not coming back. I don't think I'm coming back. I've had enough. You know, a lot of karma burned through his body and his life and his experiences in the last period. I think I'm going to be done. You know, I don't really want to come back. And then toward the very end, people started asking him, well, Swamiji, you say you're not coming back. Well, he says, I know myself. And if you all need me, then, you know, he will be called back. And when we call him now, we're talking to him where he is in a place of great freedom. So in a way, we can get closer to that light than when he was in the body and, you know, the personality, the situation, all of that maybe cast a little bit of a shadow. Now he's in the light, and if we look to him there, you know, that wisdom can come to us in all the ways that we need personally.
Before you take that too far off, I know I have one question.
Okay.
When you were in the spirit of lessons from these stories, not so much of, I want to inquire into your personal stories, but as you were talking about in the beginning of, this is both good karma and bad karma to be so close and get all of these lessons, as it were. Did you know at the time that this was the, quote, good and bad karma, or was that something you realized sort of afterwards, reflecting on it later?
I would say afterward, probably. At the time, you know, it's like Ananda is now. It's so busy. It's one thing after the next. You're putting everything in, all your energy. You're meditating when you can, as deeply as you can. It's just all happening. So I really wasn't thinking, oh, gosh, I have this good karma. Oh, gosh, I have. No, I think it was after the fact. You know, and I think it was part of just seeing what's true. You know, why did that happen? Why, I didn't think of it at the time, but why was I around him more than a lot of people were? I never thought of it at the time. It just was. He'd call me and I'd go. That was it. No more, you know, deep thinking needed. I just was in the experience. But later I thought, you know, and it's true. It's just the simple truth. Because I could say, oh, that was really good karma, and think I'm going to coast on that good karma, or what, that my karma was better than others? No, it's both. If I had really good karma, I'd be liberated, right? I wouldn't be here talking about it anymore. I would be in it, gone, adorning some other planet, as Yukteswar used to say, or something. So it's not good to focus on just that. It was both. I needed, you know, my soul is still evolving, and it needed those lessons, and it needs to work on those lessons, and it'll just be finished when it's finished. So that's why I say good and bad. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always a good perspective to hold, that we get what we need. In that sense, if it's needed and I get it, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Both ways, easy or hard.
Thank you very much, Lahari. Let's mute it while we transition this to Rambhakta. Just tap it and it'll go yellow. Yep. Thank you very much, Lahari. That was great. It's always wonderful to hear these personal stories that we can translate. Do you know how this works?
Here is a book of Swami stories, and I brought it up here not because it's impressively fat. I mean, these are all double-sided pages, so there's quite a lot of it. But also to encourage you, as Lahari did, to, if you had any contact with Swamiji, to please write it down. So consider this a provocation. And it's not just for posterity, which is important, because you'll be serving people in the future who will draw huge inspiration from the stories, but also for yourself, because when you reflect on the stories and you refine them, it evokes other thoughts that might be really helpful to you, that will connect you even more deeply with Swamiji. And so I highly recommend it as a thing to do. The first time I gave this talk, I got up and I said, well, I'm writing a book about Swamiji, and the reason is because I want to provoke those old people that are Nandi who haven't got off their duffs yet and written about Swamiji. Say, I want them to have the response when they hear this to say, Rambhakta's writing a book about Swamiji. I know a lot more about Swamiji than Rambhakta does. I'm going to write a book that will put his in the shade. I have some stories here, but I thought of some things that came up in Lahari's and Shanti's talks that I should touch on. And one is the fact of Swamiji's liberation. And for 2 years I worked in the court case office. And so I was very, very conscious of the wholly fictitious image of Swamiji that SRF tried to portray. And I've always been since the very beginning when I came to Ananda for the first time. I first visited in 1974 and moved there in 1976 to the village, that Ananda had a huge role to play, and Swami had a huge role to play in the history of religion in the world, in the history of Christianity specifically. And it's always been my thought and my belief that Swami was, in fact, a Jivan Mukta, who, as Master said, only had a couple of things left to work out in his life before he would become fully liberated. And as solid scientific evidence of that, I do have a couple of stories to tell. One is seemingly trivial, but in the long run, I feel it was quite significant, which is that when I came to Ananda, I had all kinds of silly ideas about the spiritual path and kind of romanticized ideas also. And I was working at Pubble one day, Publications, and Swami came in and he visited. And as he was leaving, I thought, oh, this is my moment. I'm going to have this glorious moment with this spiritual teacher. And I'm going to declare that he's my teacher. And, of course, it'll be just like, he'll pat me on the head and he'll smile at me and he says, yes, my son, blah, 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 blah. It'll be like there are 1,000 candles glowing in the temple, and just this movie, totally out of the kung fu movie. So I go into the porch and he's starting to put on his boots and he's bent over and he's starting to put his boots on. I said, Swamiji, I think you're my spiritual teacher. So he straightens up and he says, well, I'm not a perfected being. And he finishes, puts me on his boot, and he marches out and slams the door. And but, I knew Swamiji for 39 years, and I, like Shanti, I was not really close to him in the personal sense that many people, Prahlad and other people, had this relationship with him. It was just Danny, and they could talk to him laughing and joking and messing around. But I was a complete introvert, and so I never had that kind of relationship with him. At the same time, he was a tremendous, tremendous force in my life. It was like there was always a relationship with him. There's no question of not having a relationship with him, especially living at the village and among all those people. I mean, you can be there unless you were part of his family. You know, that was one thing I recognized in my first visit to Ananda. This place feels like home. You know, I just knew it. And I'm going around. My first visit at Ananda village, because it felt like home, I had my camera with me, and I was working as a sports photographer, so I kind of knew what to do with the camera. So I decided that I was going to go around the village, and I was going to visit I was going to knock on the door of every single home, and I was going to talk to the people, and then I was going to the workplaces, and I was going to talk to everybody, and I was going to take their pictures, and I was going to take pictures of what was going on, because I wanted to know more about it. And with everybody I met, I felt that there was this calm vibration in their eyes and in their hearts and their being that was just something that I so much wanted for myself. And because they had it, and I knew that it was just the result of a spiritual life. And so, anyway, when I came to Ananda, I thought that the spiritual life was about meditation. And, you know, we'd meditate a lot, and we'd live a life of seclusion. We'd work just enough to keep the place going. You know, so I had this big idea all in my fat head, which was that I ordered an authentic Native American teepee from a place in Idaho that made these teepees. Beautiful, beautiful teepee. I ordered authentic lodgepole pine poles from an outfit in Oregon, you know. So here I am in the Bay Area living with a friend, you know, staying temporarily, and the lodgepole pine poles come, and I carefully, lovingly paint them and everything, and I've got my teepee, and finally we load it all up in his truck, and he's going to take me up to the village to dump me off, you know, to live my life there. So I get to the village, and I go out in this most remote possible corner of the Ananda land. And I set up my teepee there, you know. And I'm all set to live there and just meditate a lot and maybe see the other people that are not a little bit every day and work a little bit. I never spent a single night in the teepee. As a matter of fact, eventually a hippie lady from North San Juan moved in there, and I said, it's fine, go ahead, I'll never live there. So what I was asked to do, there was an old farmhouse at the entry to the village at the time, at the entry going up to the expanding line, I was asked to live there and take care of an 83-year-old former SRF nun who was very opinionated, and I was there to help her, you know, cook baked potatoes and chop firewood and do all this stuff. So I got to do that for a while, and then after a while, that space was needed for other purposes. You know, they're giving classes in the building, and I think it became one of the headquarters of the apprentice program at the time that Prakash was running. So the only place that I could think of to sleep was on my floor of the office in Pubble. So I took my sleeping bag there, and for months I slept on the floor at Pubble, and that was my home. And the routine was that I'd be asleep there, and about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, Swami was riding the path. At the time, 2 or 3 in the morning, the door would open violently, all the lights would go on, and Kalyani, who was a sort of supercharged nun, would come roaring in. You know, I mean, she had a head of steam like nobody else's. It was unbelievable. You know, and then she would type the latest corrections to Swami's manuscript furiously for an hour or two. And then all the lights would go off, the door would slam, and Kalyana would race out in the night to deliver the manuscripts to Swamiji. Oh, yeah. Sure, I was just in my sleeping bag on the floor, you know, zoning out. And anyway, I started talking about how Swamiji was Jivan Mukta, and this is another story that I have. I'll share it with you in case it might help you understand what I believe he was, his stature, or confirm what you think about him. I was there very early in my time at Ananda, and Nalini and I were kind of karmic friends. You know, we could talk very easily together. And so she would tell me stories about Swamiji that had happened in the very, very early days. And she told me this story about Lakshmi, who lives at the village. And Lakshmi was wanting to walk from the farm to the meditation retreat one day, and it was extremely hot. And Lakshmi was barefoot, and she was carrying Gandevi, her little daughter, baby daughter, in her arms. And she was crying as she walked up Trotterfoot Road because she felt she had to get her baby to and herself to water and shelter. So she didn't want to just stop off in among some trees and so forth. So she's going up the road weeping, and all of a sudden Swami pulls up in his old battered Volkswagen. And he says cheerfully, you know, get in, I'll give you a ride. You know. So he gives a ride up to the meditation retreat. And then the next day, Lakshmi is so grateful and so, you know, appreciative that Swami would be super consciously aware of her need, that she goes and she's telling a friend about this. And her friend's jaw drops. And she says, but that's impossible. She says, at the time when this happened, she said, I was in Sacramento where Swami was giving a class. And so she confirmed it with several other people that Swami had been in Sacramento at the time. And the thing that sort of links it up in my mind was that Swami was talking about Padre Pio one time and about how Padre Pio had appeared to other people in his physical body in several places at once. And Swamiji said that it would take a Jivan Mukta, at least, to have been able to do that. And my feeling is that Master would have had to give such a work to a person who had achieved that degree of selflessness and freedom from the ego. I mean, he could not have been a struggling monk and built Ananda, I don't think, in the way that he did, or fought the battles that he did, you know, with the power, that kind of power, unless he'd been a Jivan Mukta. And it matters to me, you know, I had one person ask me what does it matter whether it's a Jivan Mukta or not. It matters to me because of the false image that SRF has painted of Swamiji. And completely denying that, I mean, he denied that he understood Master's teachings properly, which is complete nonsense. You know, it's just the institutional mindset that they have their thing to work through. You know, I was in SRF for years, and I know that there are unquestioned saints of very high stature there, people whose sanctity I wouldn't doubt for a second. I remember being at a lay disciple banquet one time and sitting next to a very saintly young man, and he said he was watching a talk by Brother Anandamoy, and afterwards, after the talk, he realized that he'd been looking at the wall underneath Anandamoy's feet, behind Anandamoy, that Anandamoy had been levitating during the talk. You know, so these people there are no slouches spiritually, you know, and but they have an institutional thing that they have their karma to work out, and you know, Swami had a few couple of things that Master said that he had to work out before he could achieve moksha. So I think that when he died, he became a siddha, a perfected being. That's my personal Rambhakta bias, and you're free to make what you want of it. You know. But anyhow, prepare some things to read. And I will. This one's called Knee to Knee with Swamiji. And it starts, I was thrilled to be able to move to Ananda. At last I rejoiced. I could live among people who shared my spiritual ideals. We could talk about anything. Reincarnation, Yogananda, devotion. When we went to the outhouse, we could shout Hari Bol to see if it was occupied. I know I'm being silly. I doubt there are any outhouses left at the village, and there are certainly not. But Ananda felt like home. I recognized something in the people that I longed to have for myself. It was an unspoken quality of joy and inner peace that I saw in their eyes. I recognized these people as anciently familiar as my very own. If this was my home and my spiritual family, I felt that I should be part of what was going on. I longed to emerge from my hermit-like shell and to belong. But as a lifelong recluse, I had no compass for how to behave around Swamiji, and I went about it in completely the wrong way. Swamiji encouraged me not to try to put on an act, but just to be myself. Many years later, Jyotish mirrored Swami's counsel to me. He said, your role is not a public one, giving talks and being the life of the party. He said, your role is to remain somewhat apart and to write about Ananda. What is it about life's recluses that prompts us to go against our nature, our natural grain? A lunatic inspiration takes hold of us as we watch life's partygoers and event planners having fun, laughing gaily with the spiritual teacher. If I ever tried to be falsely effusive, Swamiji would become somewhat distant. It was painful to feel that I wasn't part of the scene at Ananda until I became comfortable with my own way. My wife at the time and I were having difficulty in our relationship. I wrote a note to Swamiji requesting that he pray for us. And the next day, Swamiji called and invited me to come and talk. I never liked to take up Swamiji's time, feeling that he could use it to help people with more serious problems than my own. So I said on the phone to him, I said, I really don't have to, but Swami interrupted. He says, no, Rambhakti, he says, it's important. Come on over. The next day, I arrived 10 minutes before the appointment and sat on the steps outside Swami's dome, trying to get in the proper frame of mind for a serious talk. I thought, I am not here to get a pat on the head. I'm not here for Swami to recognize or praise me. I'm here to ask for his help with the troubles we're having. When Swami answered the door, he said, let's go to the office in the music studio. I followed him through the hall to the office, where he pointed to a comfortable chair and invited me to sit down. He then drew up a second chair so close that when he sat down, our knees were almost touching. I knew that he was responding to my silent thought that I didn't want to be coddled. He gave me valuable suggestions for how I could help create harmony in our marriage. I'm writing this to help others whose nature, like mine, is quiet and reclusive, and who might not feel as a result that they are wholly part of Ananda. Another story. It was a very hot summer day at Ananda Village, and Swamiji invited the members to a pool party at Crystal Hermitage. When we arrived, I jumped into the pool and found a quiet corner. And this is where it gets kind of mixed up with the next chapter, because there's a veiled reference here to something I had to learn and the way I learned to be around Swamiji and to be in public gatherings at Swamiji's. You know, as a recluse, I was intensely self-conscious at first. And then after a while, I realized that I could be perfectly comfortable around all the extroverts and the people who were close to Swami outwardly. And I'd be perfectly comfortable and overcome my self-consciousness if the moment I arrived at Swamiji, I would find a place to sit, plant my butt there, and find one person in the whole crowd, a million people all over the place, and begin to silently pray for them. Yeah, because, you know, I could feel this very constricted consciousness. It was literally, you know, attention. Like this, you know, like, what's my place here kind of thing. But I found that I kind of had this system of prayer. I had read Swami's books. You know, my favorite books were Out of the Labyrinth, Education for Life, and later on it was Hope for a Better World. And in those books, there was this theme that there, you know, about the, he talks about the five branches of yoga. And he talks in Education for Life about the stages of a child's development. Body, feeling, will, mind, soul in six-year stages. And corresponding to the five branches of yoga, you know, karma, bhakti, hatha, karma, bhakti, jnana, raja. Okay. And anyway, I figured that if I wanted to pray for a person, I could pray for them in these five branches of their being. I could pray that they have health, and high energy and healing for their body. I could pray that their hearts be open and that they could have love in their lives, the love of others, and even better, the love, the ability to give love to others. And even better is the ability to love God with deep devotion in their hearts. So I'd start praying for them in those stages. And then when I get to willpower, that their will be strong and inspired by wisdom so that they would do activities in their lives that would bring them joy and happiness. And then for their minds, you know, cheerfulness, calmness, and expansive qualities of lifting thoughts, you know, that and noble aspirations. And finally, of course, that their souls be illuminated. So anyhow, I'd work on this, and I'd work on it. And Swami sometimes would really work on that quality in me. I remember one time I was up there at Spiritual Renewal Week, one of the first Spiritual Renewal Weeks I was ever at. Intensely self-conscious, you know. But I had a camera, and he knew I was a photographer because I'd sent him a bunch of photos. Anyway, so they decide they need a photo of all the members of Ananda, you know, with Swamiji, surrounding Swamiji. So they get out in this meadow, get Kadizzi all around their ankles, and they line up, and there's all these colorful people up there, you know. Here's Rumbakta, you know, extremely self-conscious and nervous about taking this picture. So I get out there and stands up there, and I'm just about to snap the photo when Swami yells out. He says, "Say something funny." Yeah. I wanted to melt into the bushes, you know. And yeah, you know, I later thought, you know, of course later on I thought, you know, of all the funny things I could have said. But right then I was so intensely self-conscious, my knees were actually shaking, you know. I just kind of ignominiously took the picture. "Okay, you can go have your lunch now," kind of thing, you know. And anyhow, not my most brilliant moment at all. But anyhow, I discovered this method, and what would happen was I'd be praying for this one person, and pretty soon I could actually feel the sincerity of the prayer. I could feel that my heart was actually meaning it, really wanting those qualities of that person. And then pretty soon after I continued praying, I could feel that God was enthusiastic about my prayer. So he was coming and joining in with it. And I felt that energy flowing through. And in that love, I felt such freedom that I was completely relaxed. There was no tension, no self-consciousness, nothing. And then another thing, as there was something that would always inevitably happen once I reached that point, which was that somebody would come over and sit with me. And it was never the person that I had prayed for, but we'd have a wonderful one-on-one talk. You know, it was so sweet. It really was, you know. And I had these kind of formulas that I'd picked up along the way from various people that are not like, you know, one spiritual teacher would say that every time you meet a person, say, you know, something about the light that is in you or something like that. Anyhow, just praying for people. So it was kind of a start to get sort of loosened up, but around Swamiji. But anyhow, that time I went to see Swamiji in his office, and I realized that, you know, he knew that I didn't want to be coddled. So he pulled his chair right up, and he was right there. You know, literally his knees were like this, you know, and he was telling me, talking relaxed way. So anyway, and transition now. There was a really hot day at the village, and so Swamiji invited us all over for a pool party at Crystal Hermitage. When we arrived, I jumped into the pool and found a quiet corner where I began my usual practice of trying to forget myself by choosing one person out of the crowd and praying for them. Soon I was feeling comfortable and happy, not needing to be part of the lively scene. Later on, we gathered on the patio for tea and treats while Swamiji talked and laughed with us. At one point, he mentioned the English humorist, P.G. Wodehouse. I am paraphrasing, but Swamiji said something like, "Wodehouse was a typical writer in that he was never comfortable in social situations. One time he was traveling to England on an ocean liner, and the captain asked him to read a chapter of his latest book to the other passengers. Well, he got up and sort of mumbled inaudibly. Swamiji then looked at me with a kindly smile. He said, "Look at Rambhakta. He's like that too. He doesn't say much, but he can really put it down in writing." Wallflower that I was, my greatest urge at that particular moment was to fade into the woodwork. Swamiji then thankfully turned the conversation to other topics. Asha was sitting close by, and I turned to her and chuckled, "Well, I guess he's given me permission to be the way I am." At that point, Swami interrupted what he was saying and shouted across the patio to Asha, "What did he say?" Asha yelled back, "He said you've given him permission to be the way he is, sir." Rambhakta the hermit melted deeper into the flagstone wall. Swamiji looked at me and smiled happily. I felt, you know, it was a turning point in my life that I'd sort of gotten a very important point, which is that I remember one time I praised Asha to Swamiji. You know, Asha was sort of a total role model from the very start, you know, and plus she was incredibly kind. You know, she's just, I just wholly respected that in her. So I said, "Swamiji," I remarked to him one day, I said, "You know, Asha's wonderful." And he says, "Oh, yes." He says, "She is wonderful." And he says, "So is Seva, and so are you." And it's not something that he said to me, obviously, for my ego's benefit, but just because he saw everybody as wonderful. And I mean everybody. You know, I wrote somewhere else about people who would leave Ananda because they had negative attitudes. And it was extraordinary. I was kind of lightning rod for those people. And I counted like 13, 16, 17 people who would come up to me and say something really nasty or express some nasty attitude at Ananda Village. Within 3 weeks, they'd be gone. It was weird. Yeah. And, you know, it got to where they would say something to me, somebody would say something like to me, and I would think, you know, like the Woody Guthrie song, "So long, it's been good to know you." Because they'd be gone in 3 weeks. It's just like, but there was a woman there who worked at Pubble who was unbelievable. She was so, so reactive. You know, like you'd be working in an office two doors down, and she'd hear something that you said, and you'd hear the snort and a stamped foot, you know, and you know, it was just reacting to something that she said that she didn't like. You know, she had the temper and a manner of a hand grenade. And Swami's attitude to her was extremely instructive. He was the soul of kindness to her. She never had to leave Ananda because she knew she had a problem and she was working on it sincerely, and Swami could see that. And I remember seeing Swami one day, you know, I was just stunned. Swami gave service, and afterwards he was sitting on the deck with this person. And I walked by, and it just stopped me dead in my tracks by how sweetly he was talking to her and how sweet he was being with her, and kind of encouraging her in her work. And her. I mean, that was Swamiji. It was amazing. I went over to Swamiji one time. It was during the incorporation attempt, the attempt to incorporate Ananda as a city. And all the hippies on the ridge were just totally against it, totally against Ananda. And this one guy who was sort of a super hippie came over to talk to Ananda and set him straight about stuff, you know. So I had an appointment to talk about Swamiji that day. And I arrived there, and this guy, and Swami invited me in and asked me to sit down. Later, I understood why he wanted me to come in and witness this, you know, and this guy was saying, "Well, you know, you really got to get with the program and what we're trying to accomplish here at the on the ridge, you know, and all this stuff." And Swami treated him so sweetly. He spoke to him so sweetly. You could tell he was not the slightest bit upset or reactive or anything. All he had was just love for this person. And afterwards, and meanwhile, Rambhakta's sitting there. Rambhakta wants to get up and hack the guy's head off, you know, for talking to Swamiji that way. Really, I wanted to get up. Not literally. It's not something I would do, wring his neck. But figuratively, I would figuratively do it for sure. You know? He was talking so disrespectfully and just kind of snarling, snide, you know, all this crap. So he left finally, and Swami turned to me and he said, that Richard, he's a pill. But he said it so sweetly and kindly, you know, he just completely without judgment. It's just the way the guy was. You know, he was a pill. And that's just something he had to learn by being a pill for a while, you know. And Rambhakta had to learn by being highly reactive and willing to, you know, red face, getting angry. Anyway, back to the pool party. the pool party was over. I was so exhausted from praying for people that I just had no energy. And sure enough, Swami was sitting smack dab at the only door, you know, where we would have to file past him on our way out. And I had no energy for a social encounter. So I, as we got up there, Julie and I were married at the time, as we got up there, I said, thank you, Swamiji, for having us over. You know, that was about it. I didn't say anything, and then we kind of stumbled out. But I actually wanted to run around the back to the garden wall and crawl over so I wouldn't have to go by Swamiji, you know, and think of something to say. But what it told me was that I had not discovered all there was to know about harmonizing my vibrations with other people. And that's something that I would learn much, much later with Asha's help again. And it was, I know that she helped me as Asha's channel. It was when Ishani and I got together. And when Ishani and I got together, I told the story on Ananda Garden about the Indian drums. I don't know if you read it, but that's a different story. But it was like, you know, there was no romantic phase. It was over faster than it had begun. And the divine mother said, okay, you know, we're going to get busy and do what relationship is really about. This relationship is really about. And what that involved was for about the first 7 or 8 years of our relationship, every single weekend there would just be heart-ripping, heart-wrenching, horrible pain. You know, because I, being the man who was naturally gifted with this ability, would say something completely inappropriate, thinking that, you know, it's like John Gray in his book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He gave the illustration of, you know, when a guy says something, he's got this little pea and he drops it on the floor and it goes, bing. And John Gray would get up on the stage and he'd pull out a brick and he said, this is how a woman hears it. You know, he would drop it on the floor. Bam, you know. And Ishani was perfectly, perfectly created by the Divine Mother to, sent by the Divine Mother to teach me those lessons. I mean, she had her set of lessons too, which I don't know what they were, but I can't imagine what she would have learned from me. But I mean, to me, Ishani is Divine Mother, a manifestation of Divine Mother, for the way she loved heroically through those 7 or 8 years and didn't give up. But we reached the point after that long that we were really at the end of our rope. We were exhausted, and we didn't know how we were going to carry on. So I asked Asha if she could see me for counseling. She said, yes, you can. So we met at her place, and I said, you know, Asha, there's one thing I can do that reliably resolves these disharmonies. I said, if I can get in my truck and I can go out and drive up Crystal Springs Road or up in the hill someplace, and if I can chant really, really, really earnestly for about an hour and a half, I said, by the time I get back here, I feel that Divine Mother is ready to give me the guidance that I need to you know, help create harmony. And Asha got really quiet, and I knew that she was asking Swamiji to guide her to say the next thing out of her mouth. And what she said was, she said, you know, she said it almost in a whisper, hesitatingly. It's just she didn't know if I was really ready to hear it. But she said, if you could go to Divine Mother in the moment, she said. And that was the key to healing the relationship. The next time I remember exactly where I was standing, the next time I could always feel the storm clouds kind of this kind of energy gathering where Rambaka had done something stupid. And Ishani had not yet let him know. But I could feel the storm clouds, the lightning bolts crackling off into the distance, and the nervous energy and stuff. I stopped what I was doing. I said, Divine Mother, I will do anything. I said, I will do anything to create harmony in this situation. But you must guide me. And I rejected any thought of explaining myself, justifying myself, rationalizing, getting revenge, nothing. I will do what you say, but you must guide me. I'm not going to do anything else. Every single time I did that, when the storm clouds had started together, Divine Mother gave us the harmony, gave me the harmony to nullify whatever direction I was going in. Every single time. When I meant business with her, she answered every single time. And since then, there were, for a while, obviously there were disagreements sometimes in a relationship, but nothing remotely resembling what there was once. And Swamiji was intensely aware of all that. At that interview where I talked to Asha, the first thing she told me before she gave me that advice, even before I mentioned about chanting, she said, Swamiji was, we were on the phone with Swamiji, he's over in India, and out of the blue, he said, I'm so glad that Rambhakti, Ishani, and Ishani are together. He said, I'm so happy that Rambhakti and Ishani are together. Ishani's a wonderful woman, he said. So, we're ready to give up, and how could we possibly at that point? There was no way, after Swami had said that. So, he was always aware of what was going on. Swamiji had intense love for Ishani, just because she has a really simple, really good heart, And there were three times when Ishani and I came up forward to greet Swamiji at events, and we'd kneel in front of him and so forth, and Swamiji would take her hand in both of his, and he would say, how are you, Ishani? And he would talk to her so lovingly. And I had learned by that point in time that it was a wonderful thing to happen. I couldn't be happier that he was totally ignoring me, So I would pray my ass off, pardon me, I would pray my butt off for Ishani. I'd be saying, yeah, suck it to her. Fill her right up with her. Just fill her with your love. Fill her with divine love. Fill her with your blessings. This is a good and worthy soul. You have to bless her. I would be going on like that. And at the last instance, when it was at one of the last real Maha event that Swamiji gave at the Ananda community here, it was a festival of joyful arts. It was an afternoon when Swamiji was there, and it felt like we were all being lifted into our own better selves. It was just so wonderful. I don't know what it was. It was uncanny. It was like it was a different, the world had been changed into a different place and just in that location for that time. It was all Swamiji. On that one afternoon, I found that several kind of relationships that had been a little bit iffy, they all got resolved. It was like five different people or so. It was weird. But anyway, we came up to Swamiji. And as usual, he took Ishani's hand in both of his, and he said, how are you, Ishani? And he was talking very lovingly with her. And I was doing my cheerleading act, my silent cheerleading act. I was saying, yeah. I was just grinning from ear to ear. I was so happy for her, that he was blessing her. And it was just, I had prayed on my way over there to kind of get out of Rambhakta, what did Rambhakta ever do for me kind of deal, And so finally Swami looked at me and he said, bless you. That's all he said. you know, kind of, he could feel that I was, you know, saying I don't care if he's ignoring me. And I said, at that point, I'd reached a point where I could say, I said, no, Swamiji, bless you. And I stood up, and that was the last time we ever were able to kneel before him. And I felt that that was a culmination of a whole lifetime of experience from being this extremely uptight person who was wondering about his place, you know, to where I could at least have a few experiences now and then of remembering, as I think Lahari said, you know, that the real joy is being a really simple person. You know, just a really simple person. It's like Swamiji used these two phrases at the last years of his life. He said, he praised attitudes of, you know, childlike devotion and humble service. And I feel like that was what we were all learning at Ananda Village over the years in his company. You know, all the experiences that we had were set up to teach us that lesson. And the lesson could be very difficult sometimes. You know, I remember I would go, everybody's experience was different, but I remember I would go to meetings and social gatherings at Swami's house, and there would be such a feeling of egolessness there in Swami's presence. And sometimes you'd feel yourself being worked on, and you'd feel your ego was so destroyed that you didn't know where you were standing. You didn't feel like you had a perch anywhere on the world. And it was just like falling and tumbling through psychic space. It was really difficult. It was hard to tell you. But it was a healing process. And I didn't know what to do about it. You know, I remember staggering out of there one day over, and it was, you know, night had fallen. I'm going over the trail back to the village, and I'm kind of reeling, you know, like it reminded me of a Paul Simon song, Graceland. There's a girl in New York City who calls herself the human tambourine. She says, and when I'm falling, tumbling, turning in turmoil, I say, hey, I know what she means. So anyhow, I was going over the hill, and I prayed. I said, you know, all I want to do is serve. I don't want to do anything but serve. All I want to do is serve. And the confusion completely vanished. Gone. You know, that was the lesson. Just to be simple and serve. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like, I mean, I'm still learning these things. So I've just got my learner's pit. It's permanent, literally, is what I feel like. Is that, you know, I'm learning these things. But I find that when I'm just a simple person, and if I can... It's really not easy. It's not related to... I remember one time, years ago, it happened with Swami's guidance. Swami had always urged me to chant as a way to open up my heart. So I was coming down Alma Street in a truck that I had at the time, and I was chanting, Will That Day Come to Me, Ma? And I absolutely love the Bengali version and the English version both, so I chant them in my private practice. And still, but I was chanting those, and I was thinking, you know, as I was chanting, I was thinking, I wonder what it would be really like to think of the Divine Mother as your mom, you know, your mother. And I remembered a time, my mother was from Chile, and she had a million stories about her family in Chile, our family in Chile, and some of them were hilarious because there were some real eccentric types in her family. And so when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I'd be in the kitchen with my mother, and I'd be listening to her stories, and I remember the really contented feeling I had in my heart. It was just, you know, being there with my mother and just listening to the stories. It was such a happy feeling, so much fun. She was a really good storyteller. But anyhow, so I'm going down Alma Street in the truck, and I'm chanting the song, and I'm thinking, and I managed to get into that space in the heart where I was just a little boy to the Divine Mother, again, just like that little kid. And I felt the skies part, and I felt the Divine Mother smiling at me from a very long distance away. And for hours afterwards, I was in a space where there were no boundaries between myself and everything else that existed. It was like if I was standing next to a person, it was just all one thing, you know, it was the one thing was being this person and that person. And I remember I stopped in at East West while I was in that state, and Ventul Rinpoche came over to me, and he just saw that I'd received a blessing too. And so we were kind of standing, vibing together, I guess, you know. But I've always thought, you know, when I'm chanting, I try to get in that space. Yes, okay.
Such a joy.
Yeah, and that much more reason, finish and publish.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
This is
yeah.
All three of you, thank you so much for these very personal stories. This has been, here, I'll get this on.
Okay.
This has been wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you all for, I know we've gone a little bit over tonight, and I look forward to next week.